sometimes we can use those interchangeably, sometimes that is not the case. But again, a grouping of cell bodies all together, what you would call a ganglia in the periphery, is called a nucleus in the central nervous system. In a similar vein, I put this in more as a demonstrator. This isn't a can you memorize the whole damn page type of affair. What I'm trying to indicate to you is terminology in terms of nerve tracks, which becomes important to us in terms of networking, in terms of following a neuron trail, if you will, for a particular type of function, that type of activity that we find more commonly up in the frontal part of the brain. And that is the fact that nerve tracks, if you will, tend to be named then from point of origin to point of ending. So if I say spinothalamic, you know it starts in the spinal cord and ends in the, that's the generality, okay? Now, the ones that are pictured on this descriptor are in fact those both afferent and efferent that come from the spine and go to various areas of the CNS. But again, the chart is not, hey, can you memorize all these and where they start? No. Cortical spinal, obviously, is coming back out. It's efferent. Where does it start? Hello? Cerebral cortex goes to the spinal cord, okay? So get that in mind, that's how we start looking at networks as following the trail of a major spinal nerve, excuse me, major central nervous system nerve. Point one, okay? Point two, now that we've gone through those 2 weeks of lab, as I indicated before, and as we'll talk about extensively in the second semester, the central nervous system has a lot to do with control of the endocrine system. And it does this through an endocrine gland known as the pituitary. Okay? The pituitary gland lies in a little cavity in the skull, known as the sella turcica, right under the hypothalamus. Okay? You can think of the hypothalamus as like a fruit bowl or a dessert dish that is jammed up at the base of the brain. And a lot of what is hypothalamic control comes from the comes from the base of that fruit dish. It has a little base on it, a little outcropping of the hypothalamus that looks like the base of this fruit dish. It's known as the median eminence. And that becomes important to us in terms of neural connection to and control of the pituitary. But the other thing I want, let me do this. You probably from physiology have already, you know, in anatomy, know that the pituitary has two major sections. One, the bottom end is pointing to neural hypophysis, so-called because the tissue of origin, the tissue from which it develops, is neural tissue. And if you want, you can do this. I'll do it up here. I can do it, you can do it. What we're looking at basically are neuron cell bodies that lie somewhere in the hypothalamus. We'll talk about them. And the axons project all the way out into the pituitary. So we've got a direct link here. Whenever these cell bodies are stimulated by an agonist, action potential is the same bit, only here the compound that is released is not a neurotransmitter because it does not go across the synapse or a junction. Rather, it gets released into the general circulation, goes a fair distance away, and as a result, instead of being a neurotransmitter, it becomes a hormone. Neurohypophysis works just like any other neuron, except for the fact that the compound released, when action potential gets down there, goes out into the circulation. On the other hand, the other portion of the pituitary, known as the adenohypophysis, adeno, of course, being the prefix for gland, arises from some glands in the upper oropharyngeal area. And during development of a fetus, attaches to the neurohypophysis, but it's still a separate gland. And the control of this portion of the pituitary is done through a circulatory system, a portal system, from the hypothalamus. And the important thing I want you to realize at this point, okay, is that for that portal system to work, we need to have the neurotransmitter of the hypothalamus not be a neurotransmitter anymore, but rather it's released into this portal system where it goes down and stimulates cells. Now, this here may be a couple of inches long. It's not a terrific distance, but it is a terrific distance in terms of it's not a synapse or a junction. It's definitely a lot larger than angstroms in distance. So, again, the compound comes down through here where it stimulates its target tissues. But notice up here what the compounds are that are released very often involve neurotransmitters that you're now familiar with. Dopamine and or norepinephrine become important molecules to us in terms of CNS control of the endocrine system. And as we start talking about fooling around with norepi, which you've talked about a little bit already, or dopamine or serotonin, you're talking about fooling around maybe with some endocrine side effects. And we'll talk about that a little more extensively next semester. But I just want you to understand that one of CNS important functions is to make sure the endocrine system is doing its thing correctly. Now, finally, I've got an overhead of this that I was going to bring down, and I said, no, screw it, I'm going to wait till Wednesday. Because I just want to broach the subject briefly. The CNS, okay? We're going to divide our drugs and our activities like this. And this is more historic than anything, okay? They go into general and specific. And then on each side, we're going to talk about drugs or chemicals that are general depressants, general stimulants. We're going to talk about CNS drugs that are specific depressants and specific stimulants. And as you remember from drug action, of course you remember, when I use the term specific or specificity as opposed to selective or selectivity, specific is talking about receptors, drug-receptor relationships. So when I say a specific CNS stimulant or depressant, Basically, what I'm saying is it targets a certain receptor, which in turn causes either a stimulation or a depression within the CNS. Are you with me so far? Now, here's the rub. Here's the problem. Here is the, I don't know what to call it without giving Gruber a vulgar. Because of the, it's more historical, unfortunately, but we just kind of stick with it. We talk about general depressants, and the tendency would be, general being non-specific. You know, the flip side of the coin. You know, if this is heads, what's this going to be? Unless you got a coin like I do, which is double-headed, but, you know, so that I can always get my way, I call heads. You would say specific, non-specific. Well, that's a problem. When we first put this chart together, okay, and talk about general compounds, that's what they did. They were generally depressant. There wasn't an area of the CNS they couldn't depress or stimulate. That's why they were named general depressants or general stimulants. The unfortunate thing is that they are general because they are specific. We have since determined that they act at a particular receptor, type of receptor. But the rub is that this particular type of receptor is widespread over the central nervous system. And it does its thing over a wide variety of functions at a wide variety of areas within the central nervous system. So while the drugs act specifically, their effects are noticed generally. And so that tends to be a bit of a problem. That's why I'm doing it this way, and I'll get you the sheet then on Wednesday. From a historical note, then, we're going to start over here. The general types of compounds, and particularly the general depressants, because that's the type of compound that we have the most experience with. I'll start by saying this. I want you to take this next sentence that I'm going to give you and highlight it somehow. Underline it, italicize it, put in parentheses, say Holt thinks this is important, what does he know? I don't care how you highlight it, but here's the sentence. Damn, I was so good at doing that, I forgot what the sentence was. Can't be that important. The sentence is this: generalized CNS depressants typically give you this continuum of actions. Okay? This continuum of actions. Normal, and then you go through an anti-anxiety. Notice anti-anxiety, then a disinhibition. And if you need an example here, think ethyl alcohol, which is a prototypes general CNS depressant. So I'm at the stage of disinhibition. It's party time stage. Let's get up on the table and dance, okay? And then we go into a period of sedation. That's where I usually was at a party. hypnosis, which is the pharmacologic term for, catch this, quote, sleep-like state, unquote. And we can do that with drugs. We don't need a watch swinging on a chain. You're getting sleepy. We'll just say, take this. Then anesthesia, coma, and death. And for the most part, the drugs we're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks follow this continuum. And moreover, the continuum is based upon dose. It's dose-related. The whole idea, we're back to Paracelsus, dose-response. Okay? So that typically, if we were going to use one of these drugs as an anxiolytic, an anti-anxiety drug, we had to find the correct dose, because if we use too much, we start seeing these other pharmacologic activities as side effects. Moreover, a lot of these drugs have some peripheral side effects with increasing dose. We'll talk about that also. But this continuum, then, was based upon dose, and most all of the depressant drugs showed this continuum. And so it was long felt, long observed, that this was what depression of the central nervous system was all about. We would get these types of effects. We're going to discover as we go through this in the next month or so that this is not the case, that in fact we can divorce activities away from this standard. But we're going to be starting here for the next couple of days at this level, talking about general anesthesia and general anesthetics. But the first comment I want to make about general anesthetics and general anesthesia is that one of the things we would like, if we're going to have an anesthetic, is a compound that gets us down to that level without a whole lot of problems going through these other levels. Does it act quickly enough? Does it depress enough so that we get through all of this disinhibition sedation phase without a whole lot of issues? Okay? So that, excuse me, that's just one of the things we'll talk about with general anesthetic and general anesthesia. So here we go. General anesthesia. Let's talk a bit first about history. We've got local anesthetics and one of them, Jim. Now, if we follow local anesthetics first, we'll talk about those in a minute, in 3 or 4 days. Sometimes, you know what? I'm losing my gun. Got it. Over Monday. I'll bring it here. sometimes I talk about local anesthetics first. Just to get them out of the way, but they fit better, usually, after we talk about anesthesia for a while. Let's talk anesthesia. Just as a word. And says without. Okay, are you with me so far? Medical terminology, did we have some of that with Mr. McMullen? Oh, yippee, I can see it. It's a pleasant experience. Aesthesia. Feeling, sensation is what that means. So we've got without feeling, without sensation. That's what anesthesia is. Interestingly enough, the term was coined, was put together, was first utilized by an attorney. An attorney that understood that malpractice might become an issue. So he wanted a term, a word to utilize when arguing about proper and improper utilization of what had been observed about a year previously. The year, in fact, is 1848. And the term was first coined and utilized by an attorney who happens to become the head of the Supreme Court a few years later. A very famous jurist in American history. The man is Oliver Wendell Holmes. He is the first one to use the term anesthesia. And again, he uses it to describe a condition that he has observed and that had first been produced in 1847. Now, a little history leading up to this. In the early 1840s, a substance had been produced called nitrous oxide, a gas. And it had become very popular, you know, with wandering snake oil salespeople in little carts and wagons and or minstrel shows. It's a little gag thing. Get people to inhale it, and you may or may not know, one of the things that happens is your laryngeal area changes and you start squeaking. You don't have a nice low voice like you usually have. It's like Donald Duck. In addition, you get enough of it, you get sort of faint. You go on kind of a mini trip, if you will. And sometimes people got disinhibited enough that they did wild and crazy things. So it became very popular. But about 3 or 4 years into it, and I'm not exactly sure if somebody fell or something, but they should have been hurt. And they weren't. And this happened in the presence of a dentist. And the dentist said, well, shoot, maybe we can, you know, do some major dental work, which in that day and age meant extraction, without all of the pain associated with it. So he utilized it. And yeah, it happened. And once this happened, got around and people started looking at different gases to see whether or not they would have this anti-pain capacity. And while not a gas, a compound that was utilized fairly quickly in this whole history, looked at fairly quickly, ether linkage with ethyl group on either side, diethyl ether. Okay. This is the prototype of a number of compounds we're going to be looking at in the next couple of lectures. What are known as volatile anesthetics. At room temperature, they are liquid. But at body temperature, they are gases. Just need to warm them slightly. So so they turn into a gas, and you can inhale them, and they will maintain as gases at body temperature. Volatile anesthesia. This is the prototype. And, the resident at a medical school got a hold of some diethyl ether and said, let's try this. And so he started doing some experiments on various animals. And then by 1847, he was ready to try and do it on a human. Now, there weren't NDAs and, you know, all the crappy paperwork that he had to do. He simply went to the head of the medical school and said, I'd like to try this. And here's why. And the guy said, okay, so a demonstration was scheduled, a surgery, and this was going to be attempted. Now, surgery in those days was kind of interesting. The patient would be wheeled in on a gurney, and the patient would be strapped to the gurney. Okay, literally strapped to the gurney. The surgeon and nursing staff would come in tucks, tails, and top hat, and the surgery would be done. Okay, now think about that. How many tuxes a surgeon might go through in a year while trying to do surgery? Be that as it may, that's how it happened. Now, the surgical suites were laid out so that there was a balcony with seats and people could watch. And essentially, the word got around and said, this is going to happen. And so basically, the whole school was there, as was most of the hospital. And the patient was wheeled in, and the surgeon got ready, and the person who was trying this out was late. And about 10 minutes after the hour, you know how much you wait for a professor, the surgeon got his knife ready and said, screw it, I'm going to operate. And he comes in right at the last minute and says, sorry I'm late, I had a couple of problems, we'll talk about those in a minute. He says, here we go. So, uses diethyl ether, patient goes down, gets anesthetized, surgery is completed. Okay, and some of the most famous words in American medicine are uttered. And the surgeon looks up at the whole hospital staff, basically toward the hierarchy of the hospital, and says, gentlemen, this is no humbug. Inscribed on a plaque in that surgery suite to this day. The hospital is Massachusetts General Hospital. The medical school, Harvard. And that hospital has basically been built around that surgical theater, which is a registered National Historical Monument. The gentleman, the resident, the first year med student, or whatever you want to call him, was named Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N, and that room is now known as Ether Dome on the National Register of Historic Places. Diethyl ether. Now, up until this time, and even after ether is discovered, you basically had a couple of alternatives for anesthesia, for surgery. Alternative one, nothing. Gut it out. Be a man. Okay? Doesn't hurt that much. Yeah, right. Two, as much Jim Beam as, or Johnny Walker as you could handle. Or Cap Morgan, or whatever your choice, Budweiser. Okay? As much as you can handle. I said, alcohol is a what? General depressant. Unfortunately, basically, you go through sedation and hypnosis, but you don't really get down to anesthesia. And three, a type of anesthesia, and pardon me if this causes a little bit of an issue in terms of your heritage, but it's commonly been termed Bulgarian anesthesia. Okay? And basically it was this. Surgeons, as they went through medical school and went into that specialty, were, I don't know if they had to pay for them or not, were given a set of concentric hard wooden bowls. And what would happen is, if the person so opted, the surgeon would find the size bowl that very snugly fit over the person's head, okay, and then would hit them with a sledgehammer. In other words, the anesthesia was the result of a very severe concussion, which has some side effects associated with it. Okay? You know, one of which is if you hit too hard, you skull, you know, little important things like that. But that's Bulgarian anesthesia. That was a choice. So those were the choices. And so when ether is shown under the surgery to be able to put the patient into a sensation that would allow them to be cut open. I think it was an abdominal procedure, I'm not sure what. And whatever needs to be done, and then stitched back up in the recovery. It was quite a hallmark in American medicine, diethyl ether. Now, I don't know how many of you have watched Civil War things, or Ken Burns series, or, you know, various movies, Gone with the Wind, I don't care, whatever. You know that even in the Civil War, you know, I ask this question, I get amazed by the answers. It's like Jay Leno jaywalking. What year was the U.S. Civil War? I get 1492. You know, 1960. You laugh, but I said, you know, and I forget what the young lady's name was, leaders of the U.S. Civil War. She said, "Good, I don't know, I'm Canadian. What do I care?" Good for her. How many of you would that apply if I asked it? Good enough. 1861, 1865. Who's president? You know, Ben Franklin, right? Teddy Roosevelt. Then the Canadians say, "What's a president?" It's prime minister, you doofus. Okay. U.S. Civil War is like 15, 20 years later, and they're still using what out in the field? Jim Beam, Johnny Walker. Not only for its depressant activities, but first of all, they splash it over the wound because it's a good antibacterial, antiseptic, hurts like hell, stinks, but okay. So it takes a while for it to catch on, but certainly by the 1880s, diethyl ether is being commonly used, at least in hospital situations, for its anesthetic properties. And it is the anesthetic of choice until probably World War II-ish, or just after World War II, when we start trying to find better alternatives, diethyl ether. Prototype. I'm not sure if I give you this chart this time or not. Is it in your packet somewhere? Yes or no? stating it because of her standard wrestling, that it's a no? Okay, good. This is a chart that was commonly, listen, don't start copying the damn thing, okay? Listen to me. Chart that was commonly in every surgical suite in the country. It was developed by a gentleman by the name of Goodell, physician, and who was an anesthesiologist, and it was an attempt to try and show the various stages of depression with diethyl ether. And while they roughly correspond to this continuum, okay, look at the four main stages: analgesia, delirium, surgical anesthesia, and then respiratory paralysis leading to death. While they commonly somewhat correspond to this continuum that I gave you, not quite exact, but it was produced by Goodell to show the, or give the anesthesiologist some indication of where a patient was in this whole generalized depressant scheme. And what we generally try to get to in terms of anesthesia was stage 3, surgical anesthesia stage, plane 3. Because you'll notice that particular stage is divided up into 4 levels. We call them planes. And basically, this was a stage that was deep enough to provide for not coming back out when the knife starts working, and minimal upset in terms of respiration. Notice it says respiratory effort, mostly abdominal, mostly with the diaphragm. We didn't have to worry if we were doing thoracic surgery about the intercostal muscles and all of that. And so got us deep enough, and yet gave us just a bit of a cushion, not much of one, so that if we did have kind of a little bit of an overdose, we weren't going up straight to respiratory paralysis, i.e. death. So we got them as deep as we could without getting them dead, if you will. And so put this together, and again, the big thing was, as the patient is going down, we can follow their reflexes and other signs, dilated pupils and all sorts of stuff, to determine how far into the anesthesia process we were. Now, a couple of things. One of the things this tells you, and one of the problems with ether, is that it has a relatively slow onset. And so you could follow the person with these reflexes as you took them down with ether. And one of the real issues with ether became the length, the length of time it took them to go through the stage of delirium. People would be talking, they wouldn't realize it, but staff would, talking, swearing, singing, moving, spasming, laugh, shout. The one that was really kind of a problem was number 4. They would lose it, literally, on the operating table. So, that's one problem with ether. And the second problem that we'll talk about on Wednesday is that this is for ether. It doesn't necessarily apply to other volatile or gas anesthetics. And moreover, this is for ether by itself. In order to get around some of the problems with ether, we started using what we call pre-op medications, adjunct medications. And once those adjuncts were added to the mix, all bets were off in terms of these characteristics defining where we were in the depression process. Okay? Now, last thing for this morning, if I can get to it real quick. So we've got all of these compounds. We're talking about gases and or volatile anesthetics. Why are we talking about them in this physical context? As I may have indicated before, the alveoli, okay, the surface area there is thought to be 2 or 3 football fields worth of surface area. Immense surface area. Lots of vascularization. As much blood goes through the lungs as goes through the rest of the body put together. And in a combination of those two, that means if you can get something that gets absorbed through the lungs, it's going to get into the body quickly. Also be eliminated quickly if it stays as a gas. Okay? Just because it gets in the body quickly doesn't mean it gets into the CNS quickly. We'll understand that with ether on Wednesday. Okay? So we use either a gas or a volatile liquid as our anesthetic. Morton had a crude apparatus. He devised a wire mask, kind of like a catcher's mask type of thing, stuffed it full of cotton, put it over the patient, and then started dripping ether out of a bottle. What is now known as the open drop method, which was used quite commonly up in past 1900 into the 19-teens. Open drop method. Now, the big issue with that was that it was okay if you were the first surgery of the day, but if you were the fifth or the sixth, who was being anesthetized beside the patients? Or depressed, if you will. The whole staff, the surgeon and or the nurses. That tended to be an issue. So the second thing we did was we said, okay, we'll close off. And what we'll do is we'll administer through a mask. I'm just at this point, don't even look at this over here yet. We'll administer through a mask, and then we'll exit it out through the side of the hospital. Minimize the upset to the patient or to the staff while keeping the patient under. Patient breathes in the liquid that's been vaporized, which usually meant mildly warm with ether, through a reservoir bag, breathe it in through a one-way valve, breathe it out, goes through another one-way valve, and out through a hole in the wall. And this worked okay for ether, but as we started developing alternatives, they became very expensive. And so when we decide we're going to recycle, and so we get a closed circuit, gases come in, get breathed in, get recycled, and that's how we do anesthesia now, with either a gas or a bottle of liquid. Closed circuit, closed cycle. Instead of an open circuit. Okay? Now, a couple of issues here that I'm going to use as my segue. We will see you on Wednesday morning, I think, right? Wednesday at 9? All right, see you then.